article. That's at the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG, I think it is, K5RMG, Roadrunners Microwave Group. You Google those words, you will find that group, and on the bottom of their lead page, you'll find the technical information. Go to the technical information, go to the bottom of that page, and you'll find the K2RIW section. Go to the one of the 10 articles there, which is labeled Directional Coupler, and you'll find out that by very easy techniques, you can either build or buy a directional coupler on a good flea market or on eBay. There are times when you'll find a directional coupler for numbers like $10, $20, even though it originally cost $800. You can find them for very good prices because very few people know what they are. And even if the directional coupler you buy is rated from 500 to 1,000 megacycles, for instance, your next question is, can I use it at 6 meters, at 50 megacycles when it's rated from 500 to 1,000? The answer is absolutely yes. You'll get some beautiful readings way outside of the frequency range it was designed for. As long as you know a couple of other ham radio tricks, which are indicated in that article. So if you really want to measure standing wave ratio with very crafty, compact equipment that doesn't cost a whole lot of money, you've got to consider directional couplers. And with a directional coupler and that article, you'll be amazed.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You'll be amazed what you can do in order to determine standing wave ratio magnitude and exact impedance. Okay, at 9 o'clock, we usually promise everybody that we'll go over to Mel's mailbag. So what kind of burning questions have we had this week, Mel, from the guys that are in the process of getting their ham radio license? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY again. Well, didn't get a heck of a lot, but I didn't get a chance really to peruse, as they say, over it. So, I guess with field day, everything coming up this week, you know, things quieted a little bit. But all right, here's one. I'm just going to take, I look for the ones that basically, like you say, straightforward, mostly sent in from newer hands and all. I am not getting into any of these other types of discussions, which basically you do pick up later on the TechNet. This is it. It's really discussions that are more apropos to after what, 10 o'clock or whatever. All right, here's one. I picked up a, what they call an RF survey meter, wide range survey meter at a handset. And I don't understand how come the LEDs are so funny arranged. They start at the left, and it says plus 10, then it says another LED says 0, then minus 10, minus 20, minus 30, minus 40, minus 50, minus 60. What the heck am I looking at here? Okay, I think you know what it is. They most likely didn't mark it correctly. I believe, Dick, over.
I'm going to make a guess that that is a signal strength meter, either the S meter that goes into a receiver or the output meter that goes on some kind of an audio measuring device. And in the world of broadcast, for instance, quite often you're using a modulation level meter, and you would like everybody to be talking into the microphone so that the meter averages around zero. Occasionally the person does something that's a little bit too loud, and it hits as high as plus 10 dB louder than you would like to be the right kind of amplitude of modulation. But then in the other direction, as the signals get weaker and weaker, you measure minus 10, minus 20, and minus 30 decibels. Most likely, those numbers are decibels, and it sounds like very similar to what we use with a normal receiver with the signal strength meter, the S meter on the receiver. We have S0 up to S9, and then you have above that plus 20, plus 40, and plus 60 decibels over S9. So that's what I'm guessing that meter was intended to be. In other words, the instrumentation connected to that meter most likely has a logarithmic response, and now the meter is interpreting the amplitude of whatever it's measuring in decibels by taking the logarithm and multiplying them by a constant, and that comes out with some amount of current or voltage that goes to that particular meter, which is the display. That's a guess on my part. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I think I saw this once that they sell it. There's a guy who sells these things. He goes around to the hamvention. And I think I saw it. He calls it an RF level meter, RF. And it has like a little clamp type of thing on the end there, like a little clamper made out of plastic. And I think it has like sort of like a ferrite cores on there. And what I think he does, didn't do, he didn't really explain, you know. And these guys, a lot of them, they take for granted, it's in their head, so they'll say, you understand. What I think he meant by that, that the way the LEDs are arranged with this plus 10, then 0, then minus 10, I think what it is, it's actually reading in dBm thick. And so that plus 10 would be like equivalent to like 10 milliwatts. 0 would be 1 milliwatt. In other words, it's like an RF sniffing type device, I believe that it is. It's called a RF survey meter. And like I say, I saw it. It had like a little plastic clothesline thing on the end, you know, like we used to use. What do I used to use? Yeah, I guess they used to call them clothesline clip type thing, you know. And I think that's what it is. I think it means reading in dBm, so instead of putting it into a power level, he put it into dBm, over.
Is it possible this thing is intended as a RF sniffer? In other words, a radiation hazard meter. And it just so happens that the current U.S. standard, by way of the American National Standards Institute, ANSI, the C95, Charlie 95 report, by the IEEE, which has existed for more than 60 years. It represents the best compendium of all the knowledge that the United States has gathered at their best institutions and colleges and measurement laboratories and so on. Everything we know about RF is in that document per se, and that document is the defining document for NIOSH, OSHA, Department of Defense, your Navy, your Army, your Air Force, when it comes to how much RF energy are the American public or their personnel being allowed to be exposed to. The C95 document defines that. The current standard is something close to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, roughly 0 dBm per square centimeter of what's called power flux density. That's approximately the standard today. It used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. And so there's a great big safety factor built in there, by the way. So maybe this is a radiation hazard meter. It's called survey meter because that way the words are nowhere near as alarming, and is measuring power in dBm per square centimeter. What's your guess on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RYW?
If it's that one, that little handheld device that has a wire coming off of it with this little type of clamp-type device on the end of it, I think it was basically a... I think he, when the guy was selling it, I've seen it in none of my ham inventions he's been there. I think he called it an RF hunting type device, so that you could use it for, you know, going along cables and things to find out if, I guess, you got, I don't know, TBI problems or whatever heck. So, and I think the range, from what I can understand, plus 10 going down to like my minus 70. It must be in dBm, so that would give it a range. What would that be? A range of from minus 70 dBm to about 10 plus 10 dBm. I think that would be a range that it is. So it would mean that it would make sense because plus 10 dBm would be 10 milliwatts, and minus 70 dBm would be 1/100th of a, nanowatt? Picowatt. Am I correct? Over.
I'm going to show you the way that works. We'll work our way down. Minus 10 dBm is 10 decibels weaker than milliwatt. dBm is with reference to milliwatt. Decibels are always a comparison of A to B. Decibels themselves are not an absolute power unless you compare them to something. And comparing to a milliwatt. Minus 10 dBm is a tenth of a milliwatt. Minus 20 dBm is a hundredth of a milliwatt. Minus 30 dBm is a thousandth of a milliwatt or a microwatt. So minus 30 is a microwatt. Minus 60 is 1,000 times weaker than that. That's a picowatt. Minus 70 is a tenth of a picowatt. It's really 100 femtowatts. Very, very weak. And so that's a fairly sensitive meter. I'm guessing that whole chunk of instrumentation has an amplifier in it in order to get that kind of sensitivity. Now, I heard either Joe or Doug make a comment that was on top of yours because they were coming in on the Eastern input or coming into IRLP. So whoever that was, go right ahead with your comment again because you doubled and therefore I didn't quite hear it. KQRIW, listening on the TechNet.
W-H-U-S-A-Y. My comment is it's possible, you know, it's possible that you're correct in its dBm per square centimeter. I was thinking also it could be a dB above a microvolt or something like that. Anyway, that's, because it's a field strength type of measurement. W-H-U-S-A-Y, back to that.
Yeah, Doug is coming in on the eastern input of this machine, and he's got a good point. Of all the possible standards that are used when you're making decibels of power or voltage measurement, the reference could be milliwatt, watt, volt, millivolt, microvolt, ampere, milliampere. So you could have dBmV, and depending on whether the M is a big M or a little M, it could be dB with reference to millivolt or microvolt, dBma, dB with reference to a milliamp. So in the world of electromagnetic compatibility, many of their measurements are dB with reference to a millivolt or microvolt. I think a dBmV, anyhow, is their particular standard. And so since they usually measure, let me drop. When a certain amount of power is coming through space and you're standing out a reasonably far distance from the antenna so that the wave hitting you is a planar wave, you could measure milliwatts of power per square centimeter. You could measure watts per square meter. And each of those in free space, where you know the impedance of free space is 377 ohms, are with not too difficult a chunk of mathematics, can be converted into volts per meter of E field or amps per meter of H field, of magnetic field. So a 10 milliwatt per square centimeter, correction, 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, which happens to be around, I think it's 10 watts per square meter. There's a 10,000 to 1 ratio between square centimeters and square meter. So I think it's 10 watts per square meter is 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. And that also equals, I don't know the conversion right now, but some number of volts per meter of E field and some number of amps per meter of H field. So all of these are convertible between all of the systems of units. And when it comes to magnetic field, my goodness, do those people have a lot of system of units of Tesla and milli-Tesla and Oersted and lines and Gauss and whatever. There's reasons why each of those systems of units are more handy for a particular kind of measurement. And I think right now everybody's trying to standardize on the Tesla. Alrighty. Fun type meter. Want to read one more of your email requests, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Wait a minute. Let's back this up because I'm going to get questions galore. We went a little too far. Got too complicated here. Let me go with that this slow, and you agree or disagree. Let's not jump into Teslas and things, Dick. That's what people are complaining about, that we don't stick to the simple answer to the subject. All right, let me put it this way. If the first reading on this, the LED, is marked plus 10, and I say I believe it's a dBm, that would mean that it is approximately means that the power would be approximately 10 milliwatts. Or if it was going into a 50-ohm load, would mean approximately 1 volt. Am I correct so far before we go any further? Over.
If it's 1 volt of RMS into a 50-ohm system and power is E squared over R, 1 squared is 1. 1 divided by 50, I'm going to get a ratio of 1/20. 1/20 of something doesn't strike me as 1 milliwatt. It could be in fact, it's exactly a 1/20 of a watt. It's 20 milliwatts. Yeah. 1 volt RMS on a 50-ohm line, if I did the math correctly, is 20 milliwatts. Over to you, Mel. K2RIW.
No, wait a minute. No, you say, no. If I have, let's make this straight because it's going to be very confusing. Okay, let's go by zero. Okay, let's take average. 0 dBm. 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt. Would that not be equivalent if approximate potential across a 50-ohm load of 300 millivolts? Because I believe that's the way the chart lays it out. Am I correct, Dick? Now remember, 0 dBm. Forget about all the rest. We're looking at 0 dBm, if that's correct. We're looking at 1 milliwatt. That would be approximately in volts across a 50-ohm load of 300 millivolts. Correct or not? Over.
One of the big questions we've got to ask, are you using a diode rectifier on that RF energy and measuring the peak of the DC voltage out of the diode rectifier, or using some kind of instrumentation that measures RMS voltage? You'll get a fairly big difference on that one. So when you talked about 1 volt of what system of units? Peak voltage, RMS voltage, average voltage. Over to you, Mel.
Hey, I'm just trying to determine on an instrument like this how it's marked. If it was marked 0 dBm, if it was marked that way, could we agree that 0 dBm would be 1 milliwatt of power? Over.
dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt, without a doubt, 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt. And in RMS voltage on a 50-ohm line, RMS of 1 milliwatt is 224 millivolts RMS. And if I did it as a peak voltage, if my meter was perfect, it would be 316 millivolts peak. So 200 and some odd millivolts on a 50-ohm line is 1 milliwatt. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, now we're on the same page. That's what this is. It's measuring in dBm, because the way it's laid out from plus 10, then going to minus 70 dBm, most likely. So that way, you see how it is. It's based on the tens. So in other words, if we looked at zero dBm, we're looking at 1 milliwatt, and like you say, if the meter is reading the peak, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 millivolts, somewhere in that neighborhood, give or take. I mean, it's a sniffer-type device. So I think that's exactly what it is. Now I think I'm sure that the LEDs are laid out on a dBm basis. Over.
Yeah, that's one of the most powerful, one of the most popular system of units for measuring power in the 50-ohm world of the United States. Bear in mind that most of the electrical engineering world of Europe is on a 70-ohm system. On top of that, all of our cable television in the United States is on a 70-ohm system. And the reason for that is the 70-ohm cable has lower loss than 50-ohm cable, and they're paying dollars per mile of cable they're laying down, so that really counts. You got a question or a comment on this one, Wesley?
Yes. And to extend, in Europe they don't use almost, or try to avoid dB. They use microvolts. And when they try to calculate RMS, it is always 0.75.
So I think you said 75. In other words, 75 ohm is the standard for the cable, and dB with reference to a microvolt on the 75 ohm cable is their standard. And so many of their instruments are read out in that system of units. Decibels themselves, the first time you hear them, are a little bit difficult to figure out what's going on. The reason why decibels are so popular is when it comes to an amplifier increasing a signal, when it comes to an antenna having a certain amount of gain, and when it comes to reading extremely strong signals, the numbers are much more convenient in decibels. One microvolt signal on a 50-ohm line is minus 107 dBm. If you are now talking about amplifiers that have a certain amount of gain and antennas that have a certain amount of gain, and if you have to talk about these extremely small voltages in microvolts and nanovolts, and using great big exponential numbers in order to multiply these things together to find out what the free space path has created, what the antenna has created, what the amplifier has created, the numbers become kind of difficult to handle. With decibels, where the numbers are much smaller, rounder, and they combine. In other words, if I take two amplifiers that each have a 100-to-1 power ratio of their gain. Let me drop. I get two amplifiers that each have a 100-to-1 power ratio. Put in 1 milliwatt, and I get 100 milliwatts out of that particular amplifier when I'm using it within its frequency region. And I put two of those amplifiers together. The first one gives me 100-to-1 gain. The second one gives me 100-to-1 gain. Altogether, I'm getting 10,000-to-1 gain. Now, some people can handle those numbers pretty easily when they're nice, round numbers like 100-to-1. What happens if the first amplifier has a gain of 123.5, and the second amplifier has a gain of 78.9? And now you start mentally multiplying those numbers together, life gets complicated. If I told you that the first amplifier had a gain of 21 decibels, and the second amplifier had a gain of 19 decibels, the nice thing about multiplying things together when you're doing it with decibels is the multiplication becomes add. I add plus 21 dB of gain out of the first. I add 19 dB of gain out of the second. I get 40 decibels of gain altogether, and I know where I am very quickly. Whereas with the real numbers, life's a lot more complicated. It's not an ideal system, but it helps an awful lot. It has become a standard. Mel, let me send it back to you on this one. Do you think it's going to help a little bit, even though, again, we're going off to one side? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comment?
Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, pick up the comments, and then we'll go on, because it's getting late, and I think we've sort of gone through this fairly adequate. So pick up the comment, and then maybe we'll try one more, Dick. Over.
You got it, Wes.
And to extend. Well, actually, it's quite opposite in Europe. Most of the engineers are completely lost with dBs. Yes, it is a fact. I have a contact with them. I spoke with them many times. If the receiver has a sensitivity of 0.1 microvolt, and then the another stage gives 2 microvolts or 10 microvolts, the another stage gives 100 microvolts, or whatever the amplification is, everything is in the system of 10. Now, you can calculate it in your head. You don't have to think about it. Now, I admit, I'm completely lost with dBs. I have to look at the graph, and, you know, when I look at the tools that I have, I'm just gut. How nice would be that if that's in microvolt? You're talking about the army of engineers. They are simply, they cannot manage 5/8, 3/8, whatever is there, dBs. And to assume.
I'm going to agree with you in one area here, Wesley. And that is, when it comes to bench measurements of amplifiers and attenuator pads and directional couplers and mixers and IF amplifiers and filters, it is my belief that in the United States, decibels of gain or loss are used 95% of the time. But we've got a mixed set of units here in the United States. When it comes to measuring the receiver sensitivity, rarely do we ever talk about receiver sensitivity in dBm. We talk about that in microvolts. a FM receiver, a handy talkie receiver of mediocre quality, has around 0.1 microvolt of receiver sensitivity. And some really good receivers with single sideband capability are 0.01 microvolt sensitivity, which is minus 147 dBm. Almost nobody will call that receiver sensitivity minus 147 dBm in the normal two-way communication world. Of the people who do satellite communication, they do deal in dBms, and dB is in watts per square meters and so on. They do talk about receiver sensitivities, dBm. So we got mixed sets of units, and all of those people have a lot of trouble switching over to the system of units and methods of measurement done by the electromagnetic compatibility people, where everything is done in volts per meter of field strength in free space, or dB with reference to millivolt or microvolt when it comes to measurement within shielded structures. So there's mixed sets of units, and each of these, let me drop.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Each of these groups of people have a lot of trouble talking to each other. Glenn, in the world that you live in, where you're dealing with very small amounts of power at times with light-emitting diodes and these fancy high-efficiency lighting systems, and you're measuring the amount of signal you're sending down a fiber optic, kind of curious what system of units are most popular in your world, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Now we're going to get into a real can of worms with lumens and candle power. But actually, I work a lot with a lot of European engineers. At least I've dealt with Siemens, ABB. I've worked with people from Kosovo and Slovenia, and they use the same pretty much set of units that we use. It's amazing how identical how international it is today. So when we talk about dBm per power, 0 dBm, 1 milliwatt, it's all the same. I've noticed very little, if any, differences there. If you look at the EMI standards between the IEC and the FCC, they practically overlap now. Even the standards for levels, the data lines pretty much are slightly offset, for their limits versus our limits. But if you pick up a Rodin-Schwarz machine and compare it to an HP Agilent, those scales are all the same, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Glenn. Glenn, I'm going to jump off to one side here for a second because you're the guy that's got a piece of information that I need, and that is, what is the latest standard, if you happen to know, of power over Ethernet? Cat5 type cable, or maybe a Stuccia version of it. What's the maximum voltage and the maximum current I can put through it? Can I get, with current standards or waivers, slight waivers to those standards, but acceptable waivers, is there a version where I can get, say, 30 watts of power on power over Ethernet using maybe more than one of the twisted pair, of the four twisted pair, and a Cat5 cable? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
In a nutshell, yes, Dick, you can get 30 watts, and that standard is called the AT standard. So you'll look for AT compatibility for PoE, and it will definitely cover that power level. It's the only time you start really getting above and beyond that is when you're going with ultra and with like ultra power or some of the other higher power standards, and they're much more limited. And there you can get like up to about 90 watts out of a Cat5, Cat6 cable. But typically the standard is the AT, and that's pretty much accepted by everybody, including Cisco. And Cisco's kind of like the leader in all this, and they accept AT as the the 30 watt standard, and it's usually two twisted two pairs of power, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Interesting. Two of the pairs of power, and I guess the other pairs are signals forward and reverse or whatever. Ultra can go to 90 watts, I guess, with some kind of waivers or whatever. Out of curiosity, is it then two twisted pairs are giving you the 90 watts? I'm about to ask you what voltage and what current, and is that standard Cat5 cable? How do I get to 90 watts, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, there's devices called midspans. Basically, what a midspan is, it looks like something like a router, but you basically plug your Cat5 cable into it, and it has detection to detect that there is power on that cable, DC voltage on that cable, and you have to have something on the other end. Your device has basically has to give a handshake to the midspan to tell it to turn the power on. And also, the maximum voltage that is allowed has to be SELV. So pretty much the industry limits the maximum voltage stick to 57 volts max. Anything above 57 volts would go into some kind of an overvoltage before 60 volts, because 60 volts is considered non-safe to touch by just about all the safety agencies, UL, TUV, you know, the World Body for Safety. Keep everything under 60 volts. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Your SELV you just mentioned, is that an acronym? What does that stand for?
B2JXN.
You may want to pick up the other station, Dick, but off the top of my head, I don't remember the acronym off the top of my head. I'll look it up for you, but it just basically means safe to touch voltage from UL. You might want to pick up the other station. I'll look that up for you in the meantime. KC2QIQ.
Okay, I think I heard Mr. JXN. Wait for the beep and go right ahead.
Thanks, Dick. AB2JXN. X-ray Michael. Gary over here. I'm in the mobile again, so didn't make it last week either. By the time you got to me, I was home already. My question is, when you get a chance, as far as, say, a network analyzer is concerned, what is this, S1, S2, as they call it?
Yeah, in case of a voltage, vector voltage network analyzer, VNA, vector network analyzer, S1 really is S11. That means voltage reflection coefficient, expressed usually in decibels. So therefore, if I had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a particular load, your vector network analyzer will measure that as a S11 magnitude of approximately minus 10 decibels. Minus 10 decibels is approximately a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So S11 is voltage reflection coefficient. S22 really is the exact same thing, but you're measuring it on the output terminals of a device. Input terminals are number one, so S11 is voltage reflection from the input. S22 would be voltage reflection from the output. S21 is number two is the output, number one is the input, so that really means gain. S21 is forward gain. And why they talk about the output first and the input second by calling it S21 is a little bit confusing. But S21 is forward voltage gain, and S12 is reverse path voltage gain. So once you memorize those four so-called S parameters, scattering parameters, those are just the words they use, the numbers, the letters they use on the vocabulary of vector network analyzers. See if that helps a little bit there, Gary. KB2JXM, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Sounds good. Do that. Thanks for opening the door.
Gary, you were only there 5% of the time on that transmission. You were only there 5% of the time, but I sense that you were somewhat happy with the information, but I'm not sure about that one. I'll go ahead to the next one now, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, K2KEY again. All right, just got one quickie here. These are interesting ones, that's why I'm bringing them up. All right, on my HF rig, yeah? I always see they have an indication tells me how loud I'm talking into the mic, the modulation indication somewhere. How come there's nothing like that on any of the FM or your FM 2-meter 440 transceivers and all? And is there a way you can add a simple gadget? Good question, Dick. Go ahead.
KC2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Sorry, breaking, Dick, but safety Safety Extra Low Voltage, SELV. Sorry for the break-in, but I just did look it up for you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ, sorry for the interruption.
If SELV is Safety Extra Low Voltage, why would you talk about extra low voltage safety as opposed to safety low voltage or safety for high voltage? How do you interpret safety extra low voltage? How do you interpret that? I mean, if I go to low voltage and then I go to extra low voltage, you would think it would become safer. It seems a little bit crazy to use that as the acronym. Over to you, Glenn.
Oh boy, this might take a little bit of time. I'm sorry to do this, but the power companies and underwriters originally considered the power for residential power to be low voltage. In other words, anything under 400 volts for home use. So in other words, like 220, 280, 115, 120 volts, all of those voltages used in a house were considered safe voltages as opposed to anything above 400, which was considered high voltage. Now, for voltages that are safe to touch, UL gives them a special requirement, which means, in other words, you don't have that. You can actually touch it with your bare hand, and that's considered to be anything under 60, and that would be referred to as SELV, or Safety Extra Low Voltage. They're just UL definitions, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Awful glad you signed in, Glenn. That makes it a lot clearer, and it's industry standard words, even though a person being hit cold can easily misinterpret those words. Extra low voltage sounds like millivolts. Alrighty, so anything under 60 volts is considered hand touchable and moderately safe most of the time. A much, much lower voltage than that would get you in trouble if there was great big metal plates against your chest with the right kind of conductive salve on them. I could give you a lot of trouble with 20 volts in an environment like that, but that's an extremely unusual situation. Or if you're standing in salt water and your hand is touching 60 volts AC, 60 volts RMS, that is not safe. You'd be amazed how many people in past years have died because they're standing in salt water with a metal case drill motor in their hand and they're with a rotary sander sanding the bottom of their rowboat. Oh, boy. Very, very dangerous.
Can I add one more suggestion to that?
Yeah, go ahead. Add another suggestion to that one, Glenn.
In other words, when they talk about safe-to-touch voltages, they're called touch, which is usually fingers and dry area. So in other words, if you were to look at the ratings for underwriters, that would be in your house, on a carpet, basic insulation, you're touching a battery terminal or something with your fingers. That's SELV. When you're talking about human body, chest, legs, using them, then now you're talking about medical standards. The medical standards are much, much tougher, Dick, and you have to have extremely high isolation and very, very low voltages at that point. Completely different ball game. To get something electronic to be used inside an operating room, very, very difficult. The standards are very, very difficult. Leakages are extremely low. You know, microamps of maximum leakage, double insulation to power lines, and, you know, virtually you can't have any current flow into a patient. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, that makes an awful lot of sense. If you're shoving a catheter into a person's vein, artery, and it's got a saline solution or a conductive solution in it, and that catheter goes close to the person's heart, a couple of milliamperes and maybe microamperes could get him into an awful lot of trouble. So you need extremely high insulation resistance on that instrumentation when you're doing that procedure, like, for instance, doing an angiogram. Okay, in the case of Mel's original question now on the handy talkie, a handy talkie is usually FM modulated. There's good and bad about FM modulation. In the case of amplitude modulation, let me drop. In the case of amplitude modulation, if I talk into the microphone too loudly and I try to go beyond 100% of amplitude modulation, a well-designed circuit will give you the upper half of the modulation of the sine wave. The upper half usually continues to go up quite a bit further than the so-called 100% point. So if your peak envelope power is supposed to be 200 watts, your transmitter in some cases, if it's well designed, can probably have no trouble putting out 250 watts of peak envelope power on an amplitude modulated transmitter because you've spoken into the mic too loudly. However, when you do that, the bottom half of the modulation will give you some pinch off, and therefore for short periods of time you'll not be transmitting anything at all, and you'll get a little bit of distortion. So with amplitude modulation, you get some distortion, but the speech is rather easily interpreted with the distortion. In the case of FM modulation, your IF strip has a very sharp rectangular filter with very steep sides. It's a brick wall filter, so to speak, if it is a really good filter. The reason for the very steep sides on the filter is to make sure that the adjacent channel of FM does not come into your particular response of your receiver. That's the good news. The IF filter has got a very sharp response. Let me drop. The bad news is that as you over-modulate on an FM transmitter, you deviate too far, your signal will periodically go down the right-hand skirt of the guy's receiver, and on the other half of your audio, it'll go down the left-hand skirt. So in other words, you'll get significant dropouts of the audio on the positive peak of your voice and the negative peak of the voltage of your voice going into that microphone. The net result is that an over-deviated, over-modulated FM transmitter sounds ugly real fast. And pretty soon, you won't even recognize your mother's voice that's speaking to, if you know what I mean. It gets distorted so fast. To avoid that problem, almost every single FM transmitter has a built-in speech limiter circuit, which will not allow the audio to go above a specific peak envelope power of audio on both the positive half and the negative half. As such, a well-designed speech limiter circuit in an FM transmitter is extremely tolerant of you speaking too softly or you speaking too loudly. The quality of the voice changes a lot, but at least it is interpretable. So there's a lot of leeway, and in fact, there are a few FM transmitters that even go one step beyond that, where there's a kind of audio automatic gain control circuit, which automatically, for short periods of time, increases or decreases the gain in order to compensate for the portions of your speech that are too low or too loud. So because of the built-in speech limiter, because of the automatic gain control in some cases, it is extremely tolerant, and therefore you don't really need a view meter to know that you're speaking correctly. The guy you're talking to will easily interpret you, unless it's a very threshold situation, and he'll tell you, I wish you would speak a little louder, or I wish you would speak a little softer. But other than that, there's a lot of tolerance there, and you really don't need a meter if it's a well-designed transmitter, in my opinion.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
K2KEY, K2RIW, that's a bunch of opinions. Let's see how you feel on that one, Mel. You got it, Mel.
Oh, the question was, how come you never see any kind of device of any kind of indicator on any of the transceivers, whether they be handy-talky type or mobile type or whatever heck you got around? You never see that on any of the VHF, UHF units. And the question was, the second part of the question was, how could he add something to indicate whether or not he's modulating? Let's say the microphone. You gave a schlep on the microphone, one of the wires from the mic, pulled loose. How do you know you're most likely going to see when you push the talk that it's in transmit position? How do you know you're putting out any audio over?
Mel, without a doubt, you and I could add a bar graph, a light emitting diode, a very small edge reading Dawson-Val meter mover. We could add all of those things to the microphone. And therefore, when the guy pushes the push-to-talk, he could look at the top of the mic and come to a conclusion that he's too loud, he's too soft, or whatever. You and I could definitely do that. And it's not too difficult to do it. There are circuits out there that could be implemented. My point is that a well-designed, modern-day FM transmitter, whether it be a mobile rig in a car, whether it be a taxi cab rig, or whether it be a handy-talkie, a well-designed one has a degree of automatic gain control to the audio. It also has speech limiting and clipping and filtering circuits. It's got a speech processor circuit. And the adaptability, the compliance capability of that speech circuit that must be in essentially every well-designed FM circuit makes it almost unrequired. You have a huge amount of leeway between speaking too softly and speaking much, much too loudly. There's a lot of leeway in a well-designed FM circuit, therefore FM transmitter circuit, therefore it's almost not required, is my opinion. Are you saying that you believe it's required and that you think we should all be adding view meters to our microphones? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Certainly. You give a schlep on the wire here. You break the wire at the wire at the panel. There's a plug where it plugs into the rig. I did that in the mobile, and the goddamn thing wasn't modulating. I had no idea it was happening. How could I know that? Until I said, okay, nobody answers me. So then I took it down. Of course, when I got it on the bench, it was obvious that I found the problem. But how come there isn't a little LED or something that would pop on a panel or middle of some kind of indicator saying, hey, it's connecting, lighting, and that's it. One to show under, one to show over, or one just to indicate that it's modulating. Because you're not going to do you much good at the microphone, Dick, if it's broken at the panel over.
You're absolutely right, Mel, that a Cadillac...
2 meter, transmit.
You're absolutely right that a Cadillac rig, a well-designed rig, with all the bells and whistles, should have that. But now we've got a little bit of a problem. Assume now that you are ICOM, Kenwood, Yaesu, one of the major brands, and you're in a very competitive market, and you're trying to sell your handy talkie at essentially the same price or slightly cheaper than everybody else, and the circuit that you just described might take them $10 in American money to do it. For the guy who's willing to buy the premium rig, and you offer that as an option, yes. But for the general rig, because of the extra cost required for this function, yes, we do need it at times. It's just a matter of time before that coil cord going to the microphone on a mobile rig is going to give you a failure, because it's being flexed day in and day out, and it's eventually going to fail. And sure, it would be nice to know that you're no longer modulating, particularly in an emergency situation, but it's going to cost money. Do you think you can talk Kenwood, ICOM, and Yaesu into doing that? K2KEY, K2RIW.
B2HWW with a comment on this subject.
How we recognized? Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Dick, all we require, you're going to tell me that you would have a great little tchotchke to make a selling point, and all you would be adding is maybe a couple of little, either one of these little bar graphs that could cost pennies in the way they produce the stuff, or a little tiny micro LEDs, these little pinpoint things. I don't think it would add that much, and it could easily be in somewhere incorporated into that rig. I don't think it's going to cost, would add any significant amount of money, but it sure would make an interesting display, over.
I'm with you. I would like to have it. It gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling. If I could, and then here's a little bit of a problem. In the case of a mobile rig, I'd now be having an attractive nuisance, where there's now one more thing to periodically make me take my eyes off the road, look at the front panel of the rig that's on the dashboard of the car, so to speak, and stare at that meter while I'm talking to make sure that it's saying something reasonable. It's one more thing to give me a distraction off the road if you put it on the panel. The right place to put it would be on the microphone. I'm holding the microphone in front of my face. My eyes are looking straight over the top of the microphone. I'm looking at the road. In my peripheral vision, I'm seeing this display flash at me on the top of the microphone. Now, it's a relatively safe thing to do, but there's a catch. In order to put that function into the top of the microphone, I have to add some extra wires on that microphone. I've now got a non-standard coil cord, and I've got a non-standard connector going into that front panel. That's a little bit of a problem, but that's the right way to do it. On the front panel of the instrument, that's going to be creating some accidents, I think. Let's see what Howie's going to say about this. You got it, Howie. K2RIW.
K2RIW, B2HWW. Let me ask a couple of questions to you, and then I'll give you an answer. Where are you going to monitor the voltage? Where are you going to take the voltage? Are you going to take it at the end of the speech amp, after this flatter filter, where in the radio are you going to take the signal from? And by the way, just remember, it's not like sideband where you're looking at the RF output, or you're looking at the ALC current, or you're looking at the current that the PA is drawing, because here the carrier does not change, and basically the limiter is a couple of diodes. It's a couple of diodes that clip the audio stage, and then it goes into a 6 dB per octave. So you have an 18 dB filter. You need 3 sections of filter. You must have 18 dB to roll off at around 4 kHz. That's what the FCC wants. So remember, FM is different. But answer my question, Dick. Now you know where I'm coming from. Where are you going to put this idiot light? Are you going to put it before or after the speed camp? Where are you going to monitor the audio signal pump?
Because you can have a failure in the microphone itself because it's been dropped, the coil cord because it's always being flexed, the connector on the front panel, the speech amplifier because it picked up some electrostatic discharge the last time you connected the microphone. So all of these things all the way down the audio circuit are capable of having a failure. Therefore, I would put the detector, the amplitude of audio detector, right at the beginning of the thing that's called the reactance module. In other words, after the speech clipper, filter, and whatever, at the tail end of where the audio goes into the reactance modulator, which is really pulling the voltage-controlled oscillator, either in amplitude or phase, that's where I would put the detector. And I would like that detector have something like a bar chart, so I know that I'm low, medium, or high. It could be a red light that says I'm under, a green light that says I'm right on, and a red light that says I'm over. So it could either be one light, three lights, a bar chart, and while we're at it, put one more light on that front panel, which tells me that the RF output is in approximately the right range. If my rig is supposed to be putting out 30 watts, give me a green light that comes on that says that the power is greater than 20 and less than 50 going to the antenna. So now I've got confirmation of RF power output. I've got confirmation of a reasonable level of audio going into the reactance modulator. The only thing I don't have confirmation now is that the phase lock loop is doing the right thing. But built into the rig is a confirmation circuit. It's a PIC. There's a quadrature demodulator that will not allow the final stage of the transmitter to turn on if there isn't an established phase lock. So that one is almost not required. So if I'm putting in, it'd be nice to have all of those. You got it, Howie.
You already have an RF indicator. Most radios have a bar graph that's showing you, have a bar graph that looks at the, there's usually an output, there's a couple of devices there that look to protect the SWR. You have a circuit in there that looks at reflected power to cut back the last RF amplifier, the last PA stage. So you already have in almost every radio and in almost every amateur HT that I know of, your meter goes up, shows you if you're in low or high power. They're not always looking at the output, but that is telling you that if everything is okay with your pH state. As far as an audio thing, if you want to put a jack in the back of a mobile rig so you could monitor yourself if you like to record, or a monitor jack, that may be an idea. But I remember that what you're talking about is what they did in the old days with CB. They used to have a little neon bulb that would look at the modulation. They didn't look at the RF. They just looked at the last output stage of the modulator, and they used to use a little neon bulb. So in an FM, you could do it that way, but I don't think it's really necessary because it's going to give people false indications. To really know if your radio is set up correctly, you need to go to a guy like Andy, or you need to put it on a service monitor, and you want to know if you got symmetrical clipping. You want to know if your negative or positive peaks are okay, because, you know, you could have a misadjusted reactance modulator. When you set it up correctly, you look at it on the scope, you want to make sure that when you modulate, you put in a 1 kc tone, that you have you've got the deviation is equal on either side. You don't want sometimes to have a non-symmetrical deviation, Dick.
I got way off.
Yeah. What I think I'd like to see, Mel, is that when the audio going into the reactance modulator is the right level, because Howie indicated that most of the mobile rigs, for instance, do have a edge panel meter showing that you are putting RF output. And at nighttime, that panel meter is lit. So that light bulb that's in that panel meter, I could have it flicker a little bit or have a second bulb that flashes on and off. There's various ways that in that exact same display, I could find out that the audio from the microphone is getting through the coil cord, getting through the front panel connector, getting through all those stages of the speech processor, and getting down to the reactance modulator. So it wouldn't be very difficult. You and I could easily add a little bit of a flashing bulb or whatever into the panel meter display, which just by lighting up would tell me that my audio is correct. Maybe it's time we do that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Actually, because I'm looking at it right now, I have a bar display here on this little radio. Here's the mobile rig, and it tells me the power. See what power level I am. When I'm listening, if I'm listening to a station, you know, I can tell when the receive, it's an S meter. It's basically telling me how strong the signal is coming in. It would be no big deal to put a button that, just like I have, and don't tell me it's distracting, because I operate HF mobile, and that's got a lot more indicators on the HF mobile rig than it does on my VHF, UHF radio. So it's not that. It's a simple thing. All you'd have to do is push a button. It would be, all right, a go, no go. That something, the radio seems to be working and all. At least it would tell you that so much of the radio is working rather than have to guess it. I think this should be on these radios, Dick. That's my personal opinion. Go ahead.
You've convinced me. I'm going to go along with it. Okay. You and I vote with our pocketbook. Maybe we start have to convince Southeast Asia that produces most of our rigs that we're about to demand this function. Wanna, you think we should start a campaign to do this, Mel? Go ahead.
Let me tell you something. They hear about this and all this will be a selling point. You're always looking for an edge. This is an edge. And saying, this will be the only little radio. I will come out, Kenwood, ICOM, or something. Somewhere. We're the only ones now producing a radio of handy talkies or mobile rigs and all that goes one step further than everybody else. You don't have this on yours. That, Dick, would cost them nothing because there isn't that much involved because everything is there ready on the panel over.
I like it. Time we start fighting for it. Looks like we're going to start a crusade. The TechNet on June 28th is starting a campaign to try to convince the major manufacturers, Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu, Astron, all of them, to start producing rigs with an indication, FM rigs with an indication that the proper amount of audio is getting to the reactance modulator. It's been through all of the audio circuit. That confirms you've got a microphone, a coil cord, a connector, and all of those audio stages and filtering in the speech processor circuit. So if the audio is there, we already have confirmation of the phase lock loop locking up, we already have confirmation of the power output, so now we know real, with high probability, we're on the air, we're radiating power, we've got a phase lock, and we've got audio, and now we can say these glamorous things and people are going to hear us. Okay, I like it. Paul, WS2N, what has NASA been doing? And have we heard any words yet from the AM? Have we heard any words yet from the AMS, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer that was installed on the last space shuttle visit to the International Space Station? And are they on schedule for the very last launch of the space shuttle? WS2N, a space person, K2RIW and TechNet, you got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. On the AMS, no, I haven't seen any results or any information regarding that. All I know is the last thing I heard is that's all bolted up and they checked it out, make sure everything's operating. But no pictures or data back from that. And Atlantis will be going up July 8th, providing there's no problems. No, they were checking out the external tank. The ribs on the on that tank is where they found a lot of, you know, some cracks last time. So they're going around with X-rays, checking that out. But So far, so good. No delays. I did want to get on to talk about a delay for one popular